The following shiur is recorded, edited, and presented to you by Kol HaLashon. We wish you an enjoyable and meaningful time listening.
Torreway, Northwest London. Thursday, the fifth day of Slichas, 17th of September, Chof Ches Elul, Rabbi Malcolm Herman, the inner voice of Teshuvah.
First of all, it's good to be back. It's been a very long time. I have to say, I do feel a bit presumptuous standing with you a couple of days before Rosh Hashanah, me and Ian. So I just really want to share some ideas that I have found particularly inspirational and pragmatic as well. And hopefully you will find the same. By way of introduction, I don't know if any of you receive the WhatsApp messages from Rav Biederman. But from Rav Biederman, in my view, absolutely outstanding, fantastic inspiration. And I want to start off by setting the scene with something that was shared a couple of days ago. And that is, and this really begins to create the context of what we are facing over Rosh Hashanah and the opportunity of Rosh Hashanah. The Gemara in Bava Metzia, Mora talks about a tenant farmer. Tenant farmer, different types of tenant farmer, and there's an arrangement that the tenant farmer will give a yield from the crop to the landlord. And what happens if, on that particular year, the place is destroyed by locusts or by some type of plague? And the mission is as follows. In Makas Medinahi, if it's across the whole region, then the tenant farmer doesn't have to pay. We reduce because it's not his fault. On the other hand, if it happens to be localized to that particular field, and we say to him, what can you do? It's just your bad luck and you still have to pay. So the Gemara brings the following case. What happens if he was commissioned to plant wheat, but he had his own mind and he decided to plant sowing barley? And then there is a plague across the whole region, and everything is destroyed. And comes the end of the year, and he's supposed to pay his pledge, and he turns around to the balabos, the landowner, and says, look, it was a Makas Medina. It was across the region, it wasn't my fault. Whatever I would have planted would have been destroyed. And then the balabos turns around to me and says, hang on a second, I asked you to plant wheat, and you planted barley. So Gemara has a shaila about it. On the one hand, you can say, look, whatever I would have planted, would have been destroyed. No, just think about it, there's another option. A landlord can say, had you planted wheat as instructed, then have a Makayim be, Vasigzor Omer Vayakamla. Then the Pasuk, the Kodesh Baruch, the Pasuk Eo, you would utter a decree, and it would be done. Had you planted wheat, then maybe it would have turned out differently for me. And Rav Biederman points out this most incredible Rashi, which he says you should look at every hour on Rosh Hashanah. Listen to Rashi. Masha tavakesh min ha-yotze yasa. That which he would have requested from the Creator, he would have done. Ba'ani lo bikashi min ha-shamayim b'chil ha-shashanah. Shiat v'tenem b'sa'onim ela b'chitim. I never put in a petition at the beginning of the year on Rosh Hashanah that barley would be successful. Wheat would be successful. I davened for wheat, and you went and planted barley. And therefore, as it were, you frustrated my tefillah. And the poor tenant farmer turns around and says, well, look, there's a plague of locusts across the whole region. He says, it doesn't matter. That is utterly irrelevant. What's the plague of locusts got to do between me and my personal tefillah? Who says my own personal tefillah wouldn't have overcome the plague of locusts? You deprive me of the opportunity to be successful. Remarkable. Remarkable. And in fact, the Tassim Shulchan Aruch and Shulchan Tefillah, like the landlord, that the tenant farmer has got to pay, because the landlord is entitled to say, who knows how successful my tefillah would have been on Rosh Hashanah. Everybody else is never struggling because the locusts hit the region. Yeah, but they didn't damn them. I was going to damn them for wheat. You planted barley. And after you frustrated my tefillah, could have overcome any impediment, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu can decree, irrespective of the statistics, irrespective of the outcome, irrespective of the surrounding circumstances, My tefillah on Rosh Hashanah has a power that could transcend that. The most incredible observation in the Gemara in Bava Mizrei, most incredible. Sometimes you come across these things and think, I've never heard this before, I've never noticed it before, come across it before. So that just sets the concept. So what I would like to do is share with you a famous question and give you a take on it, which, as I say, for me, over the last few years, has been inspirational and pragmatic as well. The question is as follows. We have Rosh Hashanah before Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah, in its most basic sense, is where we stand before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, literally stand before Melech Malkei Elohim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. 10 days later, on Yom Kippur, we go through a whole process of cleansing, rectification. All the Al-Hait, all the Al-Shamnus. You know, in the olden days, without this Masa, which I was brought up on, the Al-Hait weren't so threatening. You know, felonies and treachery and treason couldn't relate to those. When Archgold came along and suddenly translated into the modern idiom, it became a lot more scary. You know, you're going down the list and, oh gosh, I can relate to that one, on that one as well. I'll come back to that, which is so much easier. But they, well, okay, all that opportunity to cleanse ourselves. If I were to ask you, what would you prefer to have first? Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah? Surely in many respects it makes much more sense to have Yom Kippur first, to go through all the outtakes, to go through all the Ashamnus, to cleanse ourselves completely, to rid ourselves of all the Avera, and then 10 days later we stand before Kadosh Baruch Hu pristine with a restored soul, Rosh Hashanah. Good question. Fundamental question, in which there are several answers. So I would like to give an answer based on an idea that I heard many years ago, a very, very famous piece of a Gadot in the Gemara Sukkah. So that's our question. Surely Rosh Hashanah should follow Yom Kippur. Let's cleanse ourselves and then stand before Kadosh Baruch Hu. The Gemara in Sukkot Daf Nun Beis Amud Aleph. More of the context of the Gemara is actually Simchas Beis HaShoeva and the arrangements that they made in the Beis HaMikdash to separate men and women. And the Gemara brings in the call for that. And the Gemara brings from Zechariah that in the future, when Mashiach comes, there's going to be a major Levaya. The soft olav can misfade al hayopi. And there will be a Hester. The Gemara brings over there that during the Levaya, the families will be separate. And from here we learn out the importance of separation of the sexes, even if a Levaya. That's not the topic. What is this Levaya and what is this Hester? A major Hester looks like all of Kaddishah, Gan Kaddishah will be there. And they will be crying as though one is crying over an only child, not one less than. And the Gemara brings two views as to who is the deceased. Think about Rabbeisa Rabbana, Chadam Amma Shiach Ben Yosef Shinarak, Chadamma Yetzer HaRa Shinarak. First view is that Mashiach Ben Yosef. As we know, Mashiach is going to come in two stages, and the Maharshal explains that we have Beis Yosef Lahava. In order to attack and counteract Esav, we need Yosef first and foremost, and then followed up by Mashiach Ben Dovid. And this is going to be the Leviah, according to one view, of Mashiach Ben Yosef. Himself obviously being a great emissary of Klal Yisrael, and when he dies, Klal Yisrael will mourn him. The second view is that this is going to be the Leviah of the Yetzer Hara. At the end of time, you must see us, Leviah of the Yetzer Hara. The Gemara asks an obvious question. If you say it's Mashiach Ben Yosef, we understand why there is a eulogy, why there's a Hester, why people are mourning. But if you say that it is the Yetzer Hara, then why are they crying? Why are they crying? On the contrary, this seems to be the great day we're waiting for. The end of temptation, no more Lashon Hara, no more distractions from Shul, no more peribbles, nothing. That's it. This seems to be the moment to celebrate. What are they crying for? So the Gemara answers as follows. Gemara explains as follows. Because the Dorish, the Yehuda. The Asid Lavoi, Yehuda could have spoken the Yetzer Hara of a day. In the future, the Sprach will bring the Yetzer and sheft it. Mashiach doesn't mean literally shef the Yetzer, what it means is that the Rattle Yetzer will nullify and cancel out the Yetzer. If Ney are Tzadikim, if Ney are Rishoyim, Tzadikim nidma lehem kuhar gavoya, Rishoyim nidma lehem kuchusa ta'ara. So the Tzadikim, the Yetzer will be personified as a great mountain, and to the Rishoyim, it will be like a hair, a flimsy human hair. And the Gemara says, halalu boikim, halalu boikim. Both groups will be crying. Both groups will be overwhelmed with tears. Tzadikim Baruchim Armin, Aishim Homer Lichvash Hat of Rakazet. The Tzadikim were crying to say, how were we able to conquer such a great mountain? Rishonim Baruchim, Rishonim Mikraim Armin, Aishim Lo Yuchonu Lichvash Et Foot of the Ara Hazet. How is it that we are unable to conquer a hair? It's so flimsy, it's so transient, so temporary, and yet we are unable. That's the Gemara. So, first of all, the discussion is, what were they crying? Why were they crying? The Rashi says that they were crying, the Tzaddikim were crying, when they, in this Koran of Sarum, they were crying when they recalled the pain that they had in the conquest of the exiles in their lifetime. They were crying at pain of the past, how difficult it was, how demanding it was, how painful it was, they were crying. The Rashi questions Rashi, because he suggests that for them to be crying about the pain of the past doesn't seem to be relevant at this moment now. He suggests maybe it was a cry of simcha. On the contrary, they were crying overwhelmed with joy at the achievement that they had made. On the other hand, that doesn't seem to quite fit with the fact that it was a hesped, because a hesped implies that this is a moment of solemnness and mournfulness. The Maharsha also asks interesting questions. More in Sanhedrin questions, what is the purpose of a hesped? Is a hesped there to salute the person that died? More in Men Robin Sanhedrin. Or is a hesped there to salute those around? To cure the fire? And who's it for? Now, to say this is to salute the Yetzer Hara, that's a bit difficult. Hesped for the Yetzer Hara. On the other hand, what are the tzaddikim gaining from it? So Marshall suggests, and in fact, as you know, in the Medrash Shiur, when it says, "Vayalakim Hashkol Asher Osam," and they tov ma'od, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created all that there was, all that there is, and they tov ma'od. But Chazal say tov ma'od, actually, when it says everything was created in an outstanding way, it's actually reference to the Yetzer Hara. So the Yetzer Hara is our ultimate enemy. The Yetzer Hara is our ultimate ally. Without the Yetzer Hara, there is no opportunity to grow. No opportunity to grow because there's nothing to conquer at all. And therefore, from the outset of creation, Toiv Ma'oid is a reference to the Yetzer Hara. Therefore, says the Maharshal, in his chap, it could be that this is what they are crying for. They recognize that from this moment onwards, there is no further opportunity for growth. That's it. No further opportunity to grow. And therefore, the Hesped is saluting them, but it's also a moment of anguish for them. It's a moment of anguish for them, but unfortunately, no more opportunities to speak Lashon Hara. No more opportunities to talk in Shul. No more opportunities to Vital Torah. I mean, it means there's no more opportunities for growth. No more opportunities. We only become when we overcome. That's how we become. So at that moment, on the one hand, it's a moment where it could trigger celebration. On the other hand, there's a certain anguish that I'm unable to move forward anymore. That's it. The book is closed. What's finalized is finalized. That is how the Maharshal knows. I would like to share with you a pshat that I heard, I believe, about 30 years ago from Shmuel Goldberg, Shlita Mashkiach of Shari Torah. I actually called him up recently to double check the pshat, and it struck me. I thought it was so powerful. And I want to use that pshat to answer our question. And although the Maharshal will have a cash on this chat, but this is what I suggested. What does it mean that it looked like a mountain and looked like a hare? So, according to this chat, when a tzaddikim looked back at their achievement, moment by moment, day by day, it was beyond the imagination how it could have accumulated. But ultimately, these are tears overwhelmed with joy at the mountainous achievement that the tzaddikim have managed. And at the end of time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroys the Yetzer Hara, and they have a vantage point, and they can see what it meant that they overcame the Yetzer Hara time after time, day after day, moment after moment, and it's mountainous. It's enormous, beyond their wildest dreams. So then they will be overwhelmed with emotion, but positive emotion. It's true, the Hesped passion remains, but overwhelmed with positive emotion of the fact that they've achieved this incredible mountainous accomplishment decade after decade. That's how they see it. On the other hand, the Rishonim look at it, and they think to themselves, at the time it seemed insurmountable to resist Lashon Hara, to resist an unpleasant
Kol HaLashon
comment, to resist something disrespectful, to resist the Bittu Torah, it seemed insurmountable. Well, now look back on that. How long did Minnesota last? How long did the test last? Second. It's so ridiculous, I could have smacked it like a human hair. By the way, the Marshall notes that we can see it was always in the Etorah and Etov is a challenge because the Roshoim, it's a Tzadikim, it's a Har. The Roshoim, it's Stadia. Sa'ar, Har Stadia. Yet, the Marshall notes, the Etorah and Etov always go hand in hand. But coming back to this chat, that's it. So the Tzadikim are overwhelmed with tears of joy, overwhelmed with the emotions that way that they've accomplished. But the Rishoyim are overwhelmed with tears of anguish, that which they missed. So the time seems insurmountable, impossible. But ultimately, looking back, what was it? I just needed to resist for a few seconds. Just needed to hold on for a few minutes. I could have snapped it like a human hair. That's the distinction between halalaboting. Both groups are crying. So therefore, I'm going to put in the following terms. We've captured this. I said I wanted to be pragmatic. In essence, the tzaddikim are driven by a mission. And the rishayim are deflected by a moment. And the whole of life is really that clash between mission and moment. Our inner voice is a voice of mission. We know who we are. We know what we're supposed to do. We know what we want to be. That's our inner voice. But what happens? In a moment, we get deflected. In a moment, we get distracted. In a moment, we get derailed from our mission. That is the clash of life itself on a daily basis. That's what life is. Mission versus moment. Now, if we think about the Al-Khayt, what are all the Khayt? Al-Khayt from a Sufasayim, in appropriate language. Bitu is Sufasayim, careless, inconsequential talk. Lashon Hara, Nihurim. What are those that really want to be that way? That's when we allow the moment to deflect and derail the mission. Aveira is obsession with the moment. When a moment captures, Nichlas Bo Rosh Shtus, Teshuva is restoration of the mission. That's what it's all about. And successful living is when a mission drives the moment. And that's what we see from this tomorrow. In the end of time, we have this great clash and this great clarity of moment versus mission. Rishayim driven by mission, by moment, and Tzadikim driven by mission. Therefore, I would like to suggest that actually, this is the reason why Rosh Hashanah must come before Yom Kippur. It must. Because if we just had Yom Kippur before Rosh Hashanah, with all of those moments, we've got no context. Without a mission that frames the importance of those moments, we have no context in which to place them. We've got nothing to do with them. First, we have to have utter clarity of our mission. Who are we? Where are we going? What drives us? What's important to us? Only then do we have a framework in which we can place the minute and deal with the minute. If we just had the minute, it would be so small-minded. Without any context in which to place them, without any framework.
Dissipated.
Yes. We have to have that mission so that the mission can drive the moment. And that mission must come first. And Rosh Hashem says, you know what, I don't want to hear about all those moments. It's irrelevant talking about those moments. If you don't know what your mission is, then you haven't got any place to go. It's irrelevant. First, let's have clarity, absolute clarity of the mission. Last week was the was a fascinating article. I'm going to be getting that in America. Whenever I read these articles, it always upsets me. And I only find out sometimes about these emotions we're doing after they've died. I didn't know of him. And he sounded like an ongoing member. He knew him. He sounded an absolute remarkable personality. A year ago, just after he was Nifta, I read an episode about him, which captures this unbelievably. He was a postdoc in America and also extremely well known for his medical expertise, especially in the area of infertility. An unbelievable well tested. He was sitting in a dentura. And he passed him against one of the litigants in the dentura. And the man was so upset, Namasa upset that he spat in his face. Spat in his face. And Shlomo didn't flinch at all. Didn't flinch. That's an unpleasant experience when he spits in your face. And the Chavarim said to him afterwards, didn't say a word. But I understand he was upset. I understand he was upset. The person has such self-control and such clarity of who they are in their mission. Even a moment like that, which must have taken him completely by surprise, doesn't move him, doesn't flinch, doesn't change him. Mission driven. So let's take it one step further and try and give a little bit of a deeper definition of what we mean by mission. And that is based on Shmuz and Chaim Friedland and Sifrei Chaim. Sifrei Chaim about She'ifa. Asked a beautiful question. Shuvah Yisrael Ad Hashem L'Kecha, we say. Shuvah Yisrael, return Yisrael Ad Hashem L'Kecha to Hashem L'Kecha. So, obviously, Klal Yisrael have got two names, Yaakov and Yisrael. And we know that unlike Avram, when Avram's name is changed from Avram to Avram, they only ever call him Avram. Klal Yisrael have two names, two passports. Very useful. Magid Vav, Yaakov and Mishpatav and Yisrael. Two Madregas, two names. And the golden rule is that when we are in a higher place, we are referred to as Yisrael. Yisrael Kim, it celebrates the moment when Yaakov Avinu overcome the Malach. When we're on a lower Madrega, we are referred to as Yaakov. Now this particular sentence, the Lobby says to Klal Yisrael, Shuvah Yisrael, return Yisrael, as Hashem Elokecha. So he's talking to Klal Yisrael when they're in a low place, when they're degraded, when they've been sinning, when they need rebuking. And yet he refers to them not as Yaakov, but as Yisrael. Surprise number one, should be Shuvah Yaakov. Not only that, the Gemara over here in Yuma, based Gemara over here, and Peivav in Yuma, says, Ad Hashem L'Kecha, focuses on the word, Ad Gedolah Teshuvah Shemageh, Ad Kisei HaKavod. Teshuvah is so great that it reaches the Kisei HaKavod, the divine throne. And Chaim Friedland brings from on the Zohar, that the Kisei HaKavod is created through the, I'm quoting him, I haven't translated it, through a unique role an assignment of each member of Bnei Yisrael. It's our neshamas that create the divine throne. Quite what that means, I can't tell you. But our neshamas literally fashion and create the divine throne. When the neshamas are in their optimum state and in their pristine condition, they create the divine throne. So what's being asked over here? The Navi is talking to Klal Yisrael when they have sinned. First he refers to them in this kind of lordly fashion. Shuvah Yisrael. Secondly, the demand he's making of them is not, I don't want you to take small steps. Ad Hashem L'Kecha. I want you to create a teshuva which is going to literally restore the divine throne. The Pekka Fan Creamlander, this is a very demanding expectation from the outset. I mean, never so you shall have collapsed, but spiritually collapse. Surely you ought to be a little bit more gentle to set the bar so high from the outset. How realistic is that? To call them Yisrael, to demand from them that their teshuvah has got to reach Kisei HaKavod. How realistic is that? So he says the following, that a critical component, he says there's a critical component for successful teshuvah, is not just the small actions that we all have to take. Yes, we're all going to make small kabbalahs, small actions. But a critical component is ambition. A person must be ambitious in their ruchniyah. A person must be have far-sighted, have vision as to what they want to become. I would say, having that is saying, clarity of mission. A person has clarity of mission. What could I be as a yid? What do I want to be? I want to be a yid that never tells Rosh Hashanah. I want to be a yid that always concentrates on my brachos. I want to be a yid that is sensitive to other people. I want to be a yid that gives and I can give easily. That's what I want to be. And he says, if we just focus on the small actions, without a she'ifa, without an ambition, without a bigger picture of ourselves, he said, it's not going to work. We have to have that bigger picture of ourselves, the picture of the yid that we could be and want to be. Now, it may well be that maybe we won't achieve it. We won't achieve it, but the person is supposed to say, Masai Yavin on my side. when will I be able to reach the Madregas of early generation? Who can reach the Madregas of early generation? None of us. But nonetheless, if we don't have that ambition, if we don't have that drive, if we don't believe that we can achieve great things, then it's going to undermine the whole impact of our teshuva. And it gives a simple model for this. It brings a reusable in the bag. Imagine you get on the train, I've had this experience, I'm sure we all have, and the journey starts and you realize you're actually not on the right train. And on this particular occasion, the train's facing the wrong, you're going the wrong direction. First you're going north and you're going south. So the Chacham on the train thinks to himself, you know what I'll do? I'll just turn around and have feet facing the other way. Now I'm facing the right direction. Maybe facing that direction, we're traveling in the wrong direction. So the small mice thing we do is turning around. Well, first you've got to get off the train and get on the right train. You've got to get on the right train. That's what you have to do. Now, Vadim, there's no question about it. As he stresses, when it comes to the practicalities of tshuva, we've got to start with small steps without question. We've got to start with small steps. But so often we shortchange ourselves by somehow or other, I feel it so strongly that we kind of lose our capacity to believe in our own potential for greatness. I'm very fond of quoting, it's not a direct quote, but the Solomon Rebbe says, based on this, just as it's vital to believe in Hashem, just as vital to know that Hashem believes in us. Just as vital, it's not an exact quote, to believe in Hashem, it's vital to know that Hashem believes in us. Hashem believes we have the capacity for greatness, and that we have to have that ambition. And that is really what Rosh Hashanah, that answers the kasha. The Navi says to Kaddish Shal, Shuvo Yisrael, no, from the outset, from the beginning of your Teshuva journey, you've got to see yourselves as Yisrael. You've got to see yourselves and be able to reach out, kiss our covers from the outset. You're not there yet, you're a long, long way off. But that's a critical component in the journey itself, that it has ambition. But from the outset, you see that ability. Augusta actually explains elsewhere. That's why the Shivrei Luchos were kept in the Aron HaKodesh. Shivrei Luchos were kept in the Aron HaKodesh. You would imagine the best thing to do with the Shivrei Luchos was to bury them. They were the past. Please, can we start again? Let's have a clean slate. No, says Shivrei Luchos. Because that would have implied you can't get there again. That was in the past, and maybe you can't reach. No, they were kept in the Aron HaKodesh. So that Kaddish Shal could see, you know what? Maybe one day we'll get back to that point. Because having ambition in Ruchnius is a driving force which will then allow us to transform, to create real mission, to understand real mission, and then boom. I'm going to finish off by smuggling in a 60-second. It's a very well-known story, but I feel it captures everything I've been trying to share. And there's a Sam Shmulevitz in the Mir in Shanghai. And it was only Yom Kippur, and the heat was stifling, and he jammed a very, very long Shmoneh Esra, and the boys already finished Ne'ilah and Ma'ariv, and they planned together and were given a surprise. They'd run downstairs, have something to eat, and go back to the base of Medrash, and when he turned around and finished Shmoneh Esra, he'd see all the boys running there, giving him that. And that's what they did, beautiful idea. And Taka, they're all, by the time he turns around, takes three steps back, the whole base of Medrash full of boys running. So he goes to the podium, says this remarkable marshal. I'll say it very briefly. There was once a very wealthy man who built a building. A very big building. And on top of the building, he wanted to erect some kind of statue or plaque in his own honor. And they elevate him on a crane to the top of the building. And there's a great big gust of wind, and suddenly the gust blows him up and he falls off the building. And he's concussed on the ground. As he comes around and people revive him, he says, oh, about my building's collapsed, my building's collapsed. And they said, no, you've collapsed. Your buildings remain standing. So the Sfarim Levitz, complimenting the boys, look what you've built over Yom Ram. You've built an edifice, a divine edifice, a spiritual edifice. It's true that during the year, there's going to be collapses. As long as that's life. But that doesn't take away from the building. The building in Yom Ram is a building that will remain the whole year round. And the Mitzvah Shem will be the guide and set the barometer for the whole year out. I would say this is the answer to the question. Over Rosh Hashanah, we have to have clarity of mission, and we have to think high, and we have to be ambitious, and we have to be determined, and we have to dream big in Rosh Hashanah. Because we're building a building. That's what we're building in the next 10 days. And amidst Hashem, that building should stand us in good stead, so that first of all, we're more able to deal with the moments when they come along, and remind ourselves, take a step back, let mission dominate moments, don't let moments be our mission. And amidst Hashem, it should be a serious conservative, a good defense to your
Merry Christmas.
The shiur you've listened to was recorded and edited for you by Kol HaLashon. You're invited to continue listening at any time to all the shiurim and drushos in all topics by all the Rabbanim on Kol HaLashon.